You're listening to the Equitopia podcast, helping horses and humans live in harmony. I'm your host, Kaylee Hansen, and today our guest is Alexis Marenbeek. Alexis is a Grand Prix Dressage trainer and small R judge based outside of Sacramento, California. She recently collaborated with Dr. Hushman, Dr. Sue Dyson, and Mary Wanless on the online conference on the qualities and attributes of a skilled rider. I had the wonderful opportunity of being her working student for close to 2 years, and she completely revolutionized my riding. I'm really excited to share this conversation with you and dive into her story.
Getting into horses was something, it sounds really corny, but I feel like I was like destined to do, or like born to do. I know like my parents have stories about me just like being drawn to horses and like just wanting to be involved in them from a very early age, even though no one in my family was in horses. Mm-hmm. It was like one of like my first words, and like as soon as I knew what they were, I was just like, oh, that thing. And I didn't have any access. It was just something that I wanted. And so what I had was like horse books and some like horse toys and things like that. I can remember like reading like training books from a very early age. Like I don't even remember what books they were, but I definitely had like books on like training and riding, not like little kids books on horses, from a really early age. And I was like, you know, at like 5, I was like, oh, I'm definitely an expert. I know all the things to know, because I was like reading all these books. I don't remember like what they were in hindsight. Like I can still distinctly like remember some of the photos and some of these books that I read, and they were all probably written like in like the 70s and 80s, and or maybe even like some of them earlier than that. And I would just like read them when I was like from like 5 to 8 years old.
That's a pretty good foundation.
Right? And some of them I know we got from the library. Like my mom would take me to the library and I would like check out just like any horse book that they had. And I would just read them.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah, my mom used to take me to the library too, and I had like a saddle seat one that I would like to read.
Yeah, I know. I know. Like I remember for sure a book that I read until it was like threadbare that I actually owned was Susan Harris's Grooming to Win. And I don't know if you ever have seen that book, and it's all drawings in it. And like, if somebody showed me a drawing of a horse and it came from that book, I could pick it out in a second. Like I practically had that book memorized. And I was just so like, I wanted to have a horse so I could braid its hair and wrap its legs.
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of people want at the end of the day.
Right? Yeah, it was kind of a funny thing, like, as a kid, and I would practice braiding on just, like, on random things. I don't remember. I think I might have had some, like, horse, like, toy or stuffed animal or something that had hair, and I would, like, practice doing button braids on it, and, like, the different braids out of the book. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then I was able to, probably like towards the later part of that age, when I was like 7, maybe like 6 or 7, my mother had a coworker who had a quarter horse mare that she just like rode on the trail and also was a brood mare. And mm-hmm. so she would take me out there and I got to like ride her at the walk. And it was like the best thing in the world. And after that, I was just like, this is everything. And I thought I was an expert because I had read all those books. So I was like, I totally know how to do everything on this horse. So I remember like riding that horse at the walk for some amount of time. I don't know how long. And then it was several years gap before I was able to take like actual riding lessons. I think I started taking like actual riding lessons in like 5th or 6th grade. And I had always, like, from the books and everything, I had always wanted to ride English. Like, it just, that's what drew me. I didn't really have a whole attraction to, like, Western saddles and Western riding for whatever reason. Just, that's mm-hmm. just what I was drawn to. So I started taking lessons at, not that there was anything super local to me, but at, you know, as close as you could get, barn. And that's just kind of how it began. And she was a a 3-day event rider, the gal that I started riding with, but I don't think really many of her students like actually evented. It was like a little riding school program at a larger barn. Mm-hmm. And I rode there for a number of years. And then I switched to another barn in the area that was and it still is one of the last like kind of riding school barns in the Bay Area. And mm-hmm. and they had like 50 school horses, which is really, this just doesn't exist anywhere.
No.
And so I started riding there instead. I can't even remember what the reason why we switched to me and my little like group of horse girl friends that I had made at the original barn. And we all like switched over together. And mm-hmm. there I was able to like just get more involved in like everything just by turning into like where any of my free time, if I could get someone to drive me to the barn, I would just like be there hanging out, even if I didn't get to ride. And it was really like a hunter barn, even though it was a lesson barn. And I started taking lessons with the owner of the stable. And so then you just kind of become a little bit more connected to getting opportunities and stuff, because I didn't have my own horse or money to put into it. But you have that little bit of like dedication and desire to learn and to apply yourself, then you get to do a little more, I think, if you're in that kind of setting. And so I got to ride outside of lessons on some of the school horses and things, and riding some horse, like eventually in high school, it led to me like doing a lot of catch riding at the hunter shows. And I just rode anything that people would put me on or ask for. And like some shows I would ride 5 or 6 or 7 different horses in the hunter rings, and sometimes horses I didn't know before, and just like get on and ride in the warm up for 5 minutes and then like go jump fences.
Wow.
Yeah. Once I was in high school, like in the summers, I was teaching a lot for that barn, like teaching little kids up down lessons, and then getting to ride quite a bit. The owner of the barn really believed in like buying mostly younger horses to eventually become lesson horses, so that they would get like trained in that environment and they would kind of have a cleaner slate. And she took really good care of them from a vet standpoint. So that was nice to like have that framework be put on me at an early age of like, hey, if you start them young with good habits and you like take care of them from a vet and nutrition standpoint and saddle fit, like the saddles got fitted to the lesson horses, that got kind of put on me at a young age, which I think a lot of people don't necessarily have really good holistic like horse care experiences starting out in riding. And that was happening there. Mm-hmm. So that was cool to see. And so I got to ride a lot of the like future lesson horses as like an older teenager, because they weren't really ready to go into like the just general lesson work population. And in the summers, I was riding like 8 or 10 horses a day. And so at, you know, 15, 16, 17, you get really a lot of skills when you get to do that. And a lot of people don't get to do that, to just ride a diversity of horses at a young age. And I think that helped me tremendously, even if it wasn't ultimately like where I ended up in the discipline that I ride in and everything. It just like I got to experience a lot of different types of horses and learn to adapt and feel them and ride a lot on my own, which also I don't think some people get to do when they're younger, is just like ride on their own and listen to the horse and just like figure it out instead of always being in a lesson. Yeah. So, and then after that, I actually did buy a horse from her that she had purchased to be a school horse. And I was riding him and I just was like, I love this horse. I want this horse. And so I like saved my money and I bought that horse at 17 instead of buying a car like most people did. And I had him until I don't know, maybe like 25, something like that. And I actually ended up trading him for a Thoroughbred gelding that became my like first real dressage horse. Like, so when I had the original horse, I was eventing a little bit and showing some in the hunters and equitation rings, and he just wasn't going to keep moving up in the jumping the way that I wanted to, or the way that I envisioned myself moving up in the jumping. And I traded him for this rescued thoroughbred who had like 20 rides on him with a cowboy. but he was bigger and more athletic. And I thought, oh, this is going to be my next event horse. And like, this is what I want to do. I want to event. I don't want to do the hunters because I can't afford to have a horse that's going to be competitive. Mm-hmm. And that horse, the thoroughbred, promptly injured himself really severely. Like a month after I had him, he got cast in his stall and fractured his upper hock joint. And oh. Yeah, and he had surgery to repair the damage. And I was thinking that it probably wasn't prudent to think of him as an upper level jumping prospect at that point. And yeah. I loved the horse and I didn't want to get rid of him. And that's when I just was like, well, maybe I'll just show him in dressage. Like, maybe I'll just do that instead. And it just kind of like led to this cascade of me being really, really into just doing dressage. And I end up getting my bronze medal on that horse. And yeah. And then it was kind of like no looking back, basically, even though in more recent years, I have had a little bit of like a lust for jumping again. And yeah. I do have a horse that I jump a little bit. And I kind of think to myself, like, maybe it might be fun if she could get proficient enough over fences that I could show her a little at the local level, because so few people do more than one discipline anymore. And she's just so trustworthy that I wouldn't be like worried about developing her, where I don't really have a whole desire to like start young jumping horses anymore. But a highly trained dressage horse, actually, who likes to jump, feels very safe even if they're green over fences.
Yeah, I've learned
this.
That.
Yeah, I've learned this. Yeah, she feels very rideable. So unlike some of the young jumping horses that I once rode, where it's like, wow, it doesn't steer, but you know, we'll just jump at 3 feet, see how it does.
Yeah, that sounds a little scary.
I have sat on some horses that was like that. I was like, I don't feel like I could turn. And my trainer at the time was like, well, the gymnastic will keep him straight.
Oh, yeah, that's one way to do it.
Yeah, it's not unusual. It's not unusual. A lot of jumping horses, they like start jumping them when they only have a few months under saddle. And they're just like, well, you just put the jump in the way. It's fine. They'll figure it out. Huh. So
I did not know that.
Oh yeah, it's really common. It's really common. They start jumping them like right as they're learning to be ridden. It's an interesting thing. But I'm very out of that world now.
Yeah.
So yeah, getting really that having that horse was really the turning point where I was like, oh okay, like I'm going to do this instead. And it turned out that he had really a decent amount of ability for it. And it also made me realize that like the right riding and being like kind and fair to the horse, like brings out the best of them. And most horses are really like pretty happy to do anything if you don't make it outside of their ability. And what you ask of them is never like conflicting or against the way that their like body and emotions work, then they're just like happy to do it. It's weird to me sometimes when I hear people say things like, oh, my horse just doesn't like dressage. And I'm like, well, no, he probably doesn't like that you're kicking and pulling at the same time, or that you're riding him in a million circles and he's really unbalanced. And so that makes him like uncomfortable and unsteady on his legs, or that he can't see where he's going because he's overflexed. Like, yeah. It's not that your horse doesn't like dressage. He doesn't like being made uncomfortable. And he associates like what you're doing with him with being uncomfortable. And yeah, and it's like if you can get rid of all of those things, and suddenly the horse is perfectly happy to do it. And I think that's probably true of all kinds of things. Like some horses don't have a ton of talent for jumping big fences or cutting a cow or whatever. But I think if they understand the job and you're not overfacing their physical abilities, they're really just generally willing to try anything.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think they enjoy doing the different things.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That makes sense. So when was it that you decided you wanted to do it professionally, or did you have that plan ever since you worked at that barn?
I kind of did pretty early on. I think, and maybe this is my misinterpretation, but I think most like horse kids in the beginning think that they want to be a vet. They're like, oh, I'm going to be a vet, because that's the only career path that gets any like quote unquote mainstream attention as a possibility. Like the only like viable career you could have in animals is to be a veterinarian.
Yeah,
so I think
I want to be a vet.
Yeah, when I was like a smaller child, and I was just like, well, I'm just going to be a vet when I grow up because I like animals or because I like horses. I'll just be a vet. And then I think just getting a little further into it and then taking regular lessons, I was like, oh, that's not the only choice. And I don't really have that. I think it's not that I don't have a scientific mind, but I don't have that like, ooh, I want to take things apart and solve these puzzles kind of mindset when it comes to like the internal workings and stuff. And not all vets are surgeons, but that just that desire of like, oh, I want to get into this like problem solving and looking at data and then and that kind of stuff. And then in high school, I learned like how much math you have to take, you know, biological sciences in college. And I was like, oh, I don't know that I want to take that much math in school. Yeah. So some of the, like, just the educational deterrent of, oh, there's 9 years of college and debt, and do I really, like, is that the part that I enjoy about this? And I was like, no, I enjoy, like, riding and teaching. I don't want to just see the horses when they don't feel good. I want to be around them when they do feel good. And seeing the role model of my trainer / barn owner that was like, oh, this is a viable thing that you can do as a career path. I was like, okay, this is definitely where I'm headed. I didn't really have any idea of how to get started. And I think, I mean, this is kind of a tangent, but that's one of the big reasons why I have the kind of apprenticeship working student program that I do with my little business, is because I think there is a lot of very talented and not even talent isn't the important part, but motivated young people who don't have privilege and money. And 'cause I certainly didn't. And there's no way to get started as a professional, as a rider and a trainer and a coach, because you don't have a competition record. You don't have an expensive horse. You just have no way to get your foot in the door, even if you actually have a lot of knowledge and ability and determination. So for me, at least being able to like have a system to turn out one person at a time that is going to be able to like be better set up to just step into potentially running their own training program after they have been with me means a lot to me, because there isn't anything like that. And even in the wonderful lesson barn that I rode in, it wasn't a pipeline for producing people to go and become trainers themselves. It was just like, oh, you could learn to ride. And I think that's even like most smaller or working student programs, sometimes it's like, oh, well, you might learn to ride and you're going to do a lot of hard manual labor that's not actually going to prepare you to run your own business. So I had to kind of figure all that out on my own and do what I think sometimes people are unwilling to do, which is work another job that provides for you and like provides your living expenses, and then slowly take horse training clients in addition to that. So I worked in the restaurant industry for 13 years at the same time as I was training to varying degrees over that time period, because there was no other way I was going to like be able to provide for myself. And eventually I got to a place where I was like, oh, I can let this go and I can just train horses full time.
Well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense and a lot more, it's a lot more sustaining to have a second job to support instead of just, and then that gives you the opportunity to not just ride whatever comes to you. It seems like it sets you up to make healthier decisions of like, is this going to be a good situation for me? Is it going to be safe? instead of kind of ending up in
oh absolutely or getting burned out because you can't turn anybody away because you need the money to make a living. And and I think it is one of the reasons, even for maybe people who are more highly recognized or whatever, that they start sacrificing like their ethics in order to be successful in a financial way, because they're just like, well, I have to do this in order to keep making money, and I have to take these shortcuts and not care for or train the horses with the consistency and quality that I would otherwise if money wasn't an obstacle.
Yeah.
And even now I would never put myself in that situation. I like, if for some crazy reason, like I had to, I would in a heartbeat go get a second job that wasn't about horses so that I could still provide like the right care and training to the horses that I do work with instead, because it just, to me, it's just not worth it because the horses suffer and I'm just not willing to do that. And it's sad that I don't think most people set out to make that kind of ethical sacrifice. I think it kind of comes in and slowly happens. Maybe that's the optimist in me. I don't want to believe that anybody sets out to be like, well, I'm going to just do this business at the absolute bare minimum so I can make a living and not care about the well-being of the animals, or that I teach the right things to the people. I don't want to believe that to be true. So I'm just going to keep telling myself that that isn't how it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I really appreciated when I worked with you, was that you had that really healthy balance in your life where you weren't crazy stressed out, overworking yourself. So you were really able to give each horse the attention they needed instead of just trying to get through the day. And then that makes your riding better, the care is better, just overall, the horses are less stressed out. And I think that's something that owners should really look for when they're trying to find a trainer. I know most of the time people go to whoever's closest, but to really pay attention to the barn, how do the workers act? Is that person stressed out? Or are they really trying to make sure that the horses get what they need?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's hard. And I think that it's an industry where the people are often like overworked and understaffed. Those go hand in hand in like all aspects of barn industry things, and sometimes underpaid because they can't. It's a really difficult business to be in to break even. Like barn owners of boarding stables, like I think the best you can hope to do is to break even, and sometimes people don't realize that. So it's really, really difficult to, and you're never going to make everybody happy at all times. And I have a lot of empathy for people who own boarding stables, because I know for sure I could never do that. It just seems very, very stressful, and you're trying to make a lot of people happy and you're never going to make them all happy. And many of those people don't realize that like you don't really make any money doing it.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But no one could afford to own and board a horse except for maybe like the very, very wealthy. If you charged what like it actually took to maintain those facilities to their utmost and be like fully, fully staffed and pay that staff really well, no one could afford to board at a place like that.
Yeah. Definitely hard to find that balance. And mm-hmm. I think too, for owners to not feel guilty about not being able to afford that really fancy place that has everything perfectly, but trying to find the small ways to make their horses' lives better, because it is a very hard industry and so expensive. But I think you can do a lot even without a ton of money.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think there, and I think probably too, like some of the, in terms of like, you know, housing your horse when you don't own your own property that your horses live on, like I think probably some of the less expensive places may be actually more horse friendly. Like the horses live out, they live in groups, they get to Yeah, just like be like horses, or maybe the terrain is a little rougher. There's some hills and things like that that are actually better for them to live on than like living in a 12 by 12 flat thing, or like a, you know, pipe corral stall situation. Like, oh, they just kind of live out and it's a little rough. And yeah, and they live with a lot of other horses. It's actually better for them. So sometimes yeah. Some of those cheaper living situations are actually way horse friendlier than a very, very fancy barn where they're living in a stall and then they get turned out in a 20 by 20, which is yep. Like, that's not a pasture. It's not turnout.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
So how did you get interested in biomechanics, and kind of what were the, it seems like you've kind of gone through two different awakenings that I'm aware of with, when you first found out about Mary Wanless with GUI, and then again, when you came to that classical approach with Dr. Hauschman, also it seems like GUI really contributed to that. So maybe if you want to talk about that.
Sure. Yeah. And I would totally agree. I like, I kind of in my head, or a little bit in my like personal, like writings, like journalings, I think of like, and it was just this idea that I came up with like while journaling one day of like, you know, how often do we think about like our like personal renaissance, right? Like renaissance is a period of time in history where there's just like all this intellectual and creative discovery happening, and it just creates this cascade, right? Like where like one creative element and discovery like starts the chain of another one happening, and then all of a sudden there's like all this huge like boom of like art and science and everything. And I kind of think that to think of your journey as a rider sort of like that, like you might experience these periods where all of a sudden, like you just, there's this cascade of learning and it just changes everything for you. And so I've kind of thought about like some parts of my journey in that way. And then there's been these other spells where it's just like, everything is just kind of the same and it's more stagnant. And then I notice also that in the, like looking back in those time periods, that my horses progress less quickly than when I was just like pouring myself into like learning all these things. So, so Mary, I had known who Mary was. Like, I just like in the, what is one of those things, like she's famous enough in the riding world that I was like, oh, I've heard that name before kind of thing. And like you said, so GUI is a stallion that I ride that I've ridden for 10 years now, who, was just a very challenging soul right from the beginning. He is highly sensitive and he's very athletic and just and just kind of like emotionally sensitive too. And I really felt like the skills that I had just didn't apply to him. I was like, I don't know how to ride this horse. And it wasn't like he ever did anything what most people would consider naughty. He wasn't like bucking and rearing and refusing to do anything. I just felt like it was like this, he complies in a way, but everything feels like we're against each other and he's not happy to be ridden. And that has always been so important to me. Like, I want the horse to feel like they enjoy what they're doing and they're engaged in the work. And he felt like there was just so much tension, and he, even if he understood, it just felt like he was struggling like mentally, emotionally with it. And so I was like, there's gotta be something different. And in the beginning of me riding him, I was like, okay, well, I'll just take a lot of lessons. I'll just go and ride with everybody. And so any clinician that was going to be around, I was like, okay, maybe I'll go ride with them and like see, and they'll see it and they'll know. And basically a year or so of doing that with the same result from everyone. And they would just be like, okay, ride a half pass, ride this shoulder in. Okay, now we're going to do these transitions. And like, nobody saw it, what I was feeling. And I was showing him at the time and getting very good to high scores. But still nobody was seeing what I like knew was in there. So I kind of kept doing the, like, just the random clinic searching, basically. And I remember seeing in the California Dressage Society newsletter, like an advertisement for the Mary Wanless Clinic. And it was like, there's going to be the workshop part, and then there's a riding clinic. And I was like, Mary Wanless, that name is so familiar to me. Where have I heard that name? And then I mentioned it to one of my student and good friend. And she said, oh, yeah, I have one of her books. Do you want to borrow it? And I was like, oh, okay, so that's why I've heard that name. She's like an author. She's kind of famous. And I said, yeah. And so I borrowed the book, and it was one of Mary's older books. And if people who are listening haven't read any of Mary's books, like, Mary is an incredibly gifted writer as well as teacher. And I love to read. I love to read novels. I love to read books about horse stuff. And as soon as I started reading it, I was just roped completely in. I was like, oh my gosh, it was a page turner. I know that's probably not true for everybody, but I was like totally captivated. And I just oh my gosh, this, why have I not been thinking about riding and my body in this way before? And I want to learn this. And so as soon as I got probably not even a third of the way into the book, I signed up for the clinic. I was like, okay, yes, I'm definitely doing this. And I went to the workshop in the clinic and rode with her, and it was instantaneously game changing. As soon as I was on the horse in the arena in front of her for 5 minutes, she totally diagnosed what I was feeling and described the relationship perfectly. And I was like, oh my God, thank goodness. Cause nobody else had done that. And her changing my understanding of how I organized the tone of my body and had developed this actual relationship of the horse seeks the contact and you never pull on the reins, completely transformed the way that I rode him and my understanding of what it felt like to ride a horse from back to front. And it was something that I really didn't understand. I realized in hindsight that I didn't understand what that meant until I had that experience. And so then I was completely invested in it and was like, okay, I'm going to read all the books. I've drank the Kool-Aid. I am so on this journey, and rode with her as much as I possibly could, which included flying out of state to go do the teacher training workshops that she does, where it's all instructors and you get to teach each other on borrowed horses. And it was an invaluable experience, and it transformed my teaching as well. Cause suddenly I actually had concrete anatomy driven language and tools to get people to get their body in the kind of organization that actually gets them stability and influences the horse right away. And I had no idea that for however many years of my riding, riding since 7 years old, walking around on the quarter horse until that day, whenever that was, that nobody had ever taught me to rise the trot the right way, what the different parts of your body actually are supposed to do to follow the horse's motion in each of the gates. I had never really learned those things. You just kind of get told your position as it applies statically, and then you learn to ride in the other gate, in the gates, but they don't go into how your body works in the gates. And it seems so obvious in hindsight, but in the time, growing up as a kid, I remember learning how to give a release over fences, but I definitely don't ever remember anyone teaching me that you need to move your arms to follow the walk. That didn't happen. So it's just really interesting why there's some focus on some things and not on others. I don't think of myself as a stupid person or a terrible learner, so I don't think I blocked all of it out and I was taught it. I just think it really wasn't there.
Yeah, when I first started riding with you, my mind was just constantly blown because no one had told me what to do with my body. So I remember being like, I'm learning how to actually ride a horse for the first time, because people had told me what to make the horse do, but no one had told me what to do with my body to help the horse. And it was just, why is no one teaching this?
Yeah, Yeah, no, and that's a, and I think Mary, as a teacher, is so used to that feedback, like it doesn't surprise her at all. And I mean, she's a dry Brit, so I think like she doesn't get surprised by much anyway. Like it's just part of her personality. But yeah, it's I think she gets that response so often. Of I think one of the things she said, she relays the story about a student who came like after however many lessons was like, I think before now I was riding like semi-conscious. I just wasn't even awake. Like I didn't know because I wasn't feeling what my body was doing and tuned in to like all of the parts of my body. Like it just wasn't even awake. And I think most of us who have ridden for a very long time, like since childhood, often realized that we've been doing that and relate to that feeling quite immensely, because it's just like, you know, getting out of bed in the morning and like walking to the bathroom, like you don't think to yourself exactly how to do it and what your body is doing. You're semi-conscious. It just happens. And if you've ridden for a long time, you can get into that state very easily while riding too. You just like lose your awareness. So yeah, so Mary like woke that in me, awoke it in me. And now I hope that I am kind of following in that path of awakening other people. And when I teach them and just like showing them there's another way, and that if you learn about like your own body and its mechanics first, then inviting the horse to use themselves in the way that you would like them to becomes like the much easier task.
Yeah. It just ends up being there. That's kind
yeah,
of what
yeah,
I found
yeah,
too.
Exactly.
I'm like, oh, this is not that hard. It just flows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's a lot of work, but
yeah, but it's different. It's different work instead of like you feeling like you're having this. I have had so many experiences of students who just in the span of one lesson, like their relationship with their horse, like they realize that they have been an adversary while riding rather than like not being in the horse's way and asking for things and like allowing them to do the work that they want them to do. and they didn't know that they were being an adversary, or they thought that like riding was always going to be an adversarial relationship with the horse. And that's, it's sad to me because it doesn't have to be that way. Like it like really doesn't. And I think there's a lot of lip service to saying things like, oh, it's a partnership, it's a dance. And yeah, but somebody has to teach you the dance moves. So you can say a million times over, like, oh, you have to have a partnership, you have to love your horse, you dance with your horse. But if nobody teaches you the dance moves, you're going to be out there, you know, in the row of people line dancing, just doing your own thing. So,
yeah. That seems pretty common. And people will be like, oh, just make him do it, or he's being a jerk, or, you know, why aren't you doing that? I feel like I hear people in lessons just kind of being yelled at instead of actually breaking it down.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think far too many assumptions can happen in a riding lesson scenario where the student assumes that that the horse should just know what they want, like by, I don't know, because horses are all amazing psychic mind readers and they can pick out what you want through the potentially very confusing movements and gestures in your body. And yeah, the instructor assumes that the student has control of their body or knows how to use themselves to get the horse to comply. And so you have these like weird crossed paths of assumptions, and neither of those are usually true.
Yeah. Definitely. How did you come into the more classical approach?
So I think like just riding with Mary was already like that direction, right? Mm-hmm. That she really, it is a, you know, the thought process is like you don't pull on the reins, the horse, the going on the bit, this elusive like going on the bitness is an emergent property. It's something that the horse like does and offers you, not something that you like try to make them do. Mm-hmm. And so like I already had that and I had experienced that it was possible that it was something that was attainable, that the horse could do those things, from my work with Mary. And then, I started to just get even more interested in just like deepening my understanding of other parts of like how the horse moved and worked and functioned and their like musculature and body, and just in exploring that and realizing that I was doing kind of myself and my horses a disservice by not like constantly being on this path of educating myself and being like, oh, like I could just stay where I'm at and do what I've been doing, and it's pretty good, but there's still more out there. And then when I discovered that there was like all this more out there, and part of it actually came because of a student of mine, Jane McPeters, who's a great mm-hmm. lady, and her actually like connecting with and chatting with Caroline of Equitopia, and she was telling me that, and I met Jane through the Mary Wanless work. She was in one of the clinics in California. And she was like, oh, do you know what Equitopia is and this and that, and you should meet Caroline. And so that kind of initiated me talking to Caroline and learning about Dr. Hashman and his work. And it was sort of similar to my discovery of Mary, of like, I had heard his name before and I just couldn't remember like exactly why. But then I was like, oh, I should read some of his books. And it was like totally in line with me wanting to learn more about like the horse end of the mechanics and anatomy and like how their body functions. And that got me just like deeper into learning the like more of the history of dressage and some of the classical riding. And I'm by no means an expert on all these different masters in the past and like what their different methods were. But the overarching message and the methodology of that, like on a young horse, you don't interfere with them in what they do with their head and neck for balance. And you learn to straighten their body so that they can actually like initiate movement from this back that doesn't have any negative tension in it. And then the bending work, like correct bending work, teaches them to seek the bit and use their thoracic sling and engage the joints of all their hind legs to develop like lift and power and collection and to become a master of their own body and balance, like never to hold them and like force them there. Like you use the exercises that guide them to alignment in their spine and alignment on the line of travel in bending to become better athletes. And like understanding that just suddenly just like opened this huge thing to me. I think before that I had been riding like the dressage movements because they were the gateway to getting good scores on the in the show ring on the test. Like, oh, you have to do this shoulder in, even though you hear like, oh, the shoulder in makes the horse more collected. It makes them use their inside hind leg better. But you just ride it because you're supposed to, quote unquote. And I didn't really like feel and understand like how the horse's body could work in that shape and how that actually like talks to the different parts of their body that strengthen them and align them and change them, just as an example. And then I learned, like, I kind of learned through my own application of it, of like, oh, you don't ever like hold the horse into this. Like if they're in good alignment in their spine and you can bend them each way, you have a system of aids that bend them each way, all of these movements just kind of emerge organically out of it. Cause you just go, okay, could I align the horse this way? Oh, horse, like what happens if I align you this way and I ask you to step your front feet to this other track? And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, okay, yeah, I could do that. You know, well, what happens if we take this on the road and go sideways in the direction of the shoulders? Then they're like, oh, that's a half pass. I didn't know I was doing a half pass. Doesn't matter. Instead of this like kicking, pulling, leaning sideways, you're yanking things that I often see people doing to try to get the horse to do something, to go silent, yeah. go whatever. Yeah, all of a sudden, just like those things like emerged instead of me feeling like I was like asking for something. I like got a taste of like the dancing with them because of putting that building block of like get the horse straight and get their spine aligned with itself, right? That their pole all the way to the vertebrae in their tail make a continuous line relative to wherever they're going in space. And suddenly, like, all of a sudden, like, you have all this access to them moving, like, freely without unnecessary tension. And, yeah, and that was a huge thing. And then as soon as I had like experienced like the feeling of it, now I have a like an understanding of it and ability to articulate, I think, how to get there to my students too. And using the framework of the rider biomechanics language and methodology to apply those like classical principles of how the horse gets developed. And I think I'm doing a pretty good job of bringing those things together for people that take lessons with me.
Yeah. From what I've heard from all the people that have gone to clinics with you, or at least the ones that I've heard from, they only say great things. Of like, oh my gosh, it unlocked so much new understanding and ability to be with my horse. So I think people are really excited to learn a different way, because I think a lot of people think they're just bad riders, or their horse is bad, or mm-hmm. they kind of take it, when really I think the education and how to teach people hasn't been there.
Absolutely.
But I think it's exciting, like with Equitopia and social media, like this information is just spreading and it only helps our horses, so that's exciting.
It is. Yeah, I think that the fact that there's like all these resources actually available, where I even 10 years ago, like there just wasn't, it was much harder to come by that knowledge. And unless you were somebody who was like lucky enough to be riding with anyone who had it already, you wouldn't even know where to look. Yeah. I certainly didn't. I didn't know where to look. And I don't know actually how long like Equitopia, the site, has been around, and maybe it was out there and I wasn't on Facebook, so I didn't know to go there. But there's like so much there. And I think there is a bit of a like daunting iceberg effect of that, like, oh, once you see what's below the surface, you realize how much more is below the surface. So that like that can be a little daunting, but I do appreciate that like Equitopia has things fairly well organized in such a way that it's not as overwhelming, because you can be like, okay, like what kind of topics maybe I want to be interested in today, instead of just like, oh gosh, there's so much that I don't know. So you can take off these little chunks instead of just going, oh, I really don't know anything at all.
Yeah. Definitely understanding. And then you just did that online symposium with Dr. Hauschman, Dr. Sue Dyson, and Mary Wanless. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I was really excited to be a part of the, like, I don't know if she called it an online conference, symposium, all these different things, right? And the idea behind it was just a discussion from different viewpoints about like what it really means to be a skilled rider. And what I like took away from it, from listening to the other presenters, was like how much overlap we had, which I thought was like really nice to hear. And of course we have the data pool of like people who are kind of all invested in this holistic horse welfare approach. So we're going to have overlap because we see eye to eye on like the horse's well-being and physical and emotional well-being being so paramount to them being like successful as a riding horse or a horse athlete. Cause there are people who don't ride their horses. They drive them, they do whatever. But, yeah, so it was still kind of affirming though, to see the overlap there. That we had about like the ideas that we agreed upon of what makes somebody highly skilled. And mm-hmm. I enjoyed like reflecting too on what that meant to me, because I think it's helped me to when I teach lessons, help people to be better about like projecting how the skills that we're working on in the moment, like in one lesson, actually like come together for the whole body of skill of riding, of what they're trying to create, like long term or just like within themselves as a whole, instead of just arbitrarily in the moment, like all those lessons that I took where I got told to ride another half pass and it wasn't getting me anywhere. Like, yes, I could make the horse replicate that thing, but it didn't like actually make me a better horse person in any way. And so doing the symposium kind of made me think, okay, when I teach a lesson, like when somebody walks away from this, like, am I helping them to not just have ridden the horse like better today, but are they getting from it like this foundational skill and understanding to like actually be a better, like have a better skill set entirely. And I'm not sure in completely like what I'm doing differently to do that, but it is something that's like on my mind and trying to balance a little bit more teaching of methodology and the horse's mechanics and like the rider's body, rather than just strictly be like, okay, I'm going to put you here. Like, this is why we're going to use these muscles, because we're trying to talk to this part of the horse and get this result, and spend a little bit more time of like, okay, like the horse has to be in this alignment and we have to get them here because that's how they're going to best use themselves. And that's your forward thinking goal, even if it doesn't happen today, as it were. Yeah.
Definitely. That makes sense. Do you have a like specific experience that you could share? It could either be like a horse that you have worked with or something you see in clinics often of a problem and then the path to solving it.
So, you know, I think, and if people are interested in part of this, they can get a like more thorough explanation in the blog series that I wrote for Equitopia. I would say, I'm just trying to think of like in generalities of what I see a lot of, and I'll tell the short one first, even though it's not actually going to be at all related to the longer one. So The number one thing that I do to people that I haven't seen before in a lesson, or sometimes like people who ride with me more often, that I see is that their stirrups are not the same length. If I got paid an extra dollar every time I measured somebody's stirrups from one side to the other and evened them out, I would be a lot wealthier than I am today, because it is so common that people's stirrups are not the same length. Sometimes even like to the extent where it's like three or four holes different, I have encountered. I am not joking. Wow. And they didn't know. And it solves like a huge amount of their body issues, like instantaneously, to even the stirrups.
Yeah.
So if you have not checked the length of your stirrups left and right, and you've never done this before, and I think this is fairly easy to describe in words without like seeing a visual. If you take your stirrup iron while you're not on the horse and turn it upside down, and then use your fingers to compare where the bottom of the stirrup lines up with the bottom of your saddle flap. So if you're really tall, you'll probably fit fingers between the bottom of your stirrup and the saddle flap itself. Like, it won't reach all the way up to the saddle flap. And if you're a little bit shorter, then you'll put your fingers under the tread between the stirrup iron and the bottom of the saddle flap. And you just like count fingers to measure. And then you go to the other side of the horse and do the same thing, instead of doing that number where somebody stands in front of the horse and like sways from side to side and tries to eyeball whether the stirrups look like they line up on an imaginary horizontal line through the horse. It's very inaccurate. So measure with your fingers. Do it often. Don't assume because you measured them once that now that your stirrups are forever going to be even, because they probably won't stay that way. So that's my really, really easy advice, because I fix it so often in people in lessons. But yeah. The bigger one that you can read in greater detail in the three-part like blog series that I did for Equitopia is the following mechanics of the gates, and specifically how your arms have to move to follow the oscillations of the horse's head and neck in walk and canter. And I think so many people have this huge eye-opening moment when they realize they've been blocking the horse's back and blocking their hind legs from reaching their full potential just by not moving their arms freely enough to follow how much the head and neck moves in walk and in canter. And just changing that is like a direct link to them going more freely forward, especially in canter. I've taught a lot of people that they are like, my horse can't stay in the canter very well. I have to kick like all the time in the canter. I can't keep him going. And as soon as we get their arms moving, following the natural motion of the horse's neck in the canter, suddenly the horse is perfectly willing to stay cantering like for as long as they like. So, yeah, I think that's a really big, easy game changer for people to apply to their riding. And I would like to think it's one of those, like, if you read the blog, you can, and there's some photos, especially with the canter, you can take that and go and ride and like feel where the beats are happening and get a real feeling for like how the falling mechanics of your arms should work. And in the walk too, it's equally important and a little easier to execute because everything is happening slower. And I think that's one of those things that people could be a really good self-teacher on if they haven't ever gotten that information before. Like it's something you can walk around for a while and you can slowly figure it out of like feeling when the horse's neck goes forward and out every time one of the forefeet lands in the walk. And then it retreats, and then the neck comes back to you as the leg goes back. So you have to be able to move your elbows opening and closing to match that, so that the reins don't go slack loose or slack taut with every walk step.
Yeah, great. I think those are some really helpful tools that people can take home. Is there anything else that you want to talk about? I think we can are getting close to wrapping up. So I really appreciate all your time.
Thank you. I don't know that I have anything else than like, oh, I really wish that I had had gone over. Yeah, I don't know. Do you have any like last thoughts or anything?
I think that's about it. I really liked how hearing about your initial experiences with horses, especially reading the books and then being at that training barn where she did take really good care of the horses with the vet and saddle fitting. It really makes sense how you've ended up where you are today.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think I didn't have to have as much of a, maybe young person like renaissance of learning like, oh, everything I learned in the beginning was totally wrong, because unfortunately there are some people who have that, and it's hard because I don't like having to tell somebody that like the knowledge that they gained from somebody else that they trusted as a professional is completely off base, and nor do I think that I am the quintessential expert on everything horse. Like, I am still on my own personal journey of learning, and I want to stay open to the things that I don't know. And I think that's just like the best outlook to have to actually learn more. So I guess that could be a little like closing advice to people looking for a professional to help them in some way, and also to other professionals that might be listening. Like, don't assume that you know everything. And if somebody presents things like it's the only one way path to enlightenment, as it were, like, I would be skeptical of their knowledge, because I think anytime you think you know something like concretely, you're like, this is what I know, with beyond a shadow of a doubt to be true, then maybe the more likely it is that there's somebody out there who has the exact opposite belief, and it's also true for them. So I try not to like hold on to anything so hard and be entirely convinced that it's the right way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Oh, I came up with a good question. So how has a failure or a parent failure set you up for later success? Do you have, like, a favorite failure of yours?
That's a good question. It's an interesting question. Favorite failure. It is always really satisfying when you, like, really struggle at something and then, like, suddenly it, like, just comes together and it works, right? It seems sudden, but it actually isn't, you know? I kind of a firm believer of, like, nobody has, like, this sudden breakthrough. It's like your next, like, breakthrough is always underway. You just maybe don't notice the signs that it's happening. I did have a horse that really, really struggled with learning the flying changes. And I was kind of amazed, actually, that she never did successfully unload me in the process, because she just found it so unsettling. And there was a lot of, like, bucking and carrying on that went with the excitement of being asked to do a change. Actually more so once she kind of understood the concept, but didn't really get it. And so she would just get, like, super excited. She's like, I know we're going to do this thing, but I don't really know exactly what it is. And there was, like, a lot of bucking and, like, careening around and running away. And I just started to feel like this is never going to happen. Like, it's never going to get there. She'll just be like this forever. And I had been riding with Mary at that point, but I'd never ridden this horse with Mary, since Mary only comes to California once a year. And mm-hmm. I tried taking some lessons with a few other people here and there, just like, okay, well, what do I do? This is what she does. And it would maybe help a little bit, like the exercise that they proposed in the lesson, and we would do it. But then I would get her home and she would get acclimated to whatever that exercise might have been for the change. And then it would just, like, start over again anyway. So I was like, oh, this is never gonna, and I just kind of stayed the course of just being patient and working on her overall, like, tension and like acceptance of the work in general, and just didn't push it any differently. And I kind of taught myself that, like, if you just wait and you don't keep trying to reinvent the wheel, and you just keep riding the horse, like, kindly and working through the tension that they have about anything, and not drilling them, then it just happened. Like, she just finally was like, oh, you know what, this isn't a big deal anymore. And I also learned that it was a stretch to her physical capabilities and some of her athleticism. Like, it was genuinely physically really hard for her, and so it manifested in, like, these other things of with her body, of like, oh, this is, like, really, really hard for my body. And so that's how it came out. And mm-hmm. and I kind of learned that lesson too, of, like, if they're doing a lot of, like, stuff that just is undesirable to the rider, because I don't say, like, bad, like, that gives the horse this, like, good and evil thing where they're not good or evil, they just are, and being like, oh, they're bad or they're, you know, against you is not, like, it's only bad because we decide as a rider that it's bad, not because the horse actually says to himself, I'm bad. So, mm-hmm. you know, it was an undesirable behavior on behalf of my viewpoint as the rider for her to do those things. But as far as the horse is concerned, it was probably perfectly logical for her to respond in that way. And, like, with enough, like, just patience and not an overemphasis on it as a task, they just slowly started to emerge successfully. And it just took her that long. And it was, like, probably about a year before we mm-hmm. could do from when I started the process of, like, the idea of the flying changes to being able to do a successful flying change without bucking or running away or any of those kind of things. So,
yeah. Cool. Yeah. I have two more for you.
Okay.
Yeah. What are bad recommendations you hear in the industry a lot?
Oh, goodness gracious. I think, well, and do you mean, like, riding specific, or doesn't matter, like, care, anything?
Anything.
Anything. I think sometimes, like, care-wise, I'm really against, like, horses getting put on really long stall rests almost for like any kind of injury. And I've just seen that that ends up being detrimental. And I have some students and friends who have gone against that advice with horses with like some pretty severe leg injuries. And the outcome has been significantly better. And of course, this is all anecdotal, but that the outcome has been way better letting them like rehab in the environment that they were living in before, like the pasture setting or something, versus locking them in a box for 90 days or something or whatever it is. So, yeah. So, and of course, like, I'm not saying go against your vet's advice, but it's more of like, find a vet that wants to work with you if you have something like that or an injury. But because sometimes I just hear like, oh, the horse has a little bump, bruise, whatever, like, put them in a stall for 2 weeks, like 2 weeks of stall rest. And it's just like, oh, it ends up just being really detrimental. I feel like it's something that gets prescribed for things that it's not really a very good option for. Mm-hmm. And horses need movement. Like, movement is the cure. The right movement is the cure. Yeah.
And then adding the stress to them, and then the body won't heal as well.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because they get anxious and absolutely. Absolutely. Bad advice while riding, I think probably, and I've like really learned this and now I've totally changed my viewpoints on it through like getting more educated in like the classical riding, is that, that you should ride them long and low in the warm up, that riding them like, you know, down in the neck, pull at lower than the withers, like in the trot as a warm-up, and anatomically you're not stretching anything. Like, it's not like, and even if like I've done some distance running, I've done a little bit of being a distance runner, and my coach, who's also a good friend of mine and a horse person, she was a huge advocate of like, you do not stretch your legs before running. You jog gently, you walk, you jog, you walk. And then if you feel the need to stretch your legs, you do it after the muscles have already used themselves. So this idea of like stretching the horse's top line or like neck way down or neck from side to side, especially when the muscles haven't been warmed up through work, that somehow is beneficial to the horse, or that's going to build their top line or make them go uphill, is just not correct. It's just not biomechanically viable to how the horse's body works. This idea that putting the head down somehow brings the back up in the right way is just, it isn't true. Yeah. And you can ride your horse with his nose on the ground until the cows come home, and he might be quite relaxed, but it's never going to build to collection. Like, there's this big gap of like, where do you go from that to collection? And there isn't steps that go from that to collection.
Yeah, that makes sense. Cool. And what books do you recommend most to people, and or what are the books that have greatly influenced your life?
Dr. Hausman's books are all really good. I really like the Collection versus Contortion book, which is like his newest one. And it's also like the smallest. It's just this tiny little, short book. I don't know. It's probably 100 pages if it's 100 pages, but it's like just packed with information and really good diagrams about how the horse bends correctly. And, that one is really awesome. His other books are also really good. I have somewhat recently read The Way to Perfect Horsemanship by Udo Berger, who is like considered the most recent classical master, as it were, because he died in like the 90s or the 80s or something like that. So relatively contemporary, but kind of within this traditional riding school standpoint. And he was a veterinarian and a veterinary surgeon as well as a rider. And so that book was really, really good. And he has a really interesting discussion in the beginning of that book about like the direction of competitive horse sports versus like riding as an art. And I just found it really compelling to read. The other big one that I recommend that also my dear friend Jane McPeters turned me on to, is a book called Horses in Company. And by Lucy Reese, who is an equine ethologist. So she's studied horses in the wild and she's a scientist. She's done all this research about how horses behave in the wild and completely debunked a bunch of the herd dynamic behaviors that I think we all had ingrained in us if we started riding as children about how horses behave, like some horse behaviors because of like pecking orders and things like that. And she has debunked all of that, and that horses in the wild don't behave in the ways that we get told that some horse behaviors are because of. And I don't want to try to give a big explanation of what I mean by that. I think like, just read the book. it will like change your thinking and change the way you think about like how you interact with your horse, or like why you might need to interact with your horse in a certain way. Mm-hmm.
Cool. I will definitely have to check that one out. All right.
I'm surprised I haven't told you about that one.
I think you've mentioned it before. Yeah. And I think at that time I had so many books I was reading.
Yeah.
that yeah. it was added there, but yeah. that would be really interesting. All right. If people want to learn more about you or your work, where can they find you?
So my website, or you can find me on Facebook and Instagram. So my website is mvtraining.net. And then you can find me on Facebook under MV Training or under my name, Alexis Martin Vaig, and on Instagram at AlexisM_V.
Cool. Perfect. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.